Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. And today seems to be another of our series of old Florida days. And I guess, you know, now that we're kind of aired throughout stations in the Southeast, I'm going to start calling these back in the day days or something like that, because every state has its own interesting history and past and legends and culture. But we are talking about some of the legends and culture of Florida today. And really, we're talking about the natural history of Florida with my guest, Bill Belville, who's joining me from Sanford, which is in the Orlando area, north of Orlando. He's an author, a naturalist, and a filmmaker, and a diver, and an explorer of old Florida, which really, I guess, means nowadays disappearing Florida. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Court. Good to be here.
Nice to have you on again. We had Bill on about 5 years ago with a book that he had written at the time called River of Lakes, A Journey on Florida's St. John's River. So the books Bill has written are nonfiction books. Very interesting things, and his latest book is just out. It's called Salvaging the Real Florida, Lost and Found in the State of Dreams, put out by the University Press of Florida. So I got a copy, and it's a beautiful book. My gosh, the cover is one of the prettiest covers I've ever seen, really. It looks like you're standing on the bank of a stream or a small lake in Florida, and it's dawn, and the light's just beaming through the cypress trees. It's very realistic looking.
Thanks.
And the book is a collection of nonfiction essays. But it's not a travel guide. It's very informative about the natural history and flora and fauna of the areas that that Bill gets into in the book. But it's not just one topic like that previous book that I mentioned, which was all the length of Florida's long St. John's River. This is a collection of essays. It's not scholarly at all. Bill, is there a general theme to the current book?
The theme for the book, Court, is nature and the related sense of place that you often find in association with nature. So while that's the general theme, it's a smattering of stories, and these are all stories in terms of narratives. They start, they stop. They have to do with a quest, looking for something, whether it's real or mythic. So I'm out paddling somewhere, I'm diving under the water, I'm hiking. So these are all sort of tales that take place somewhere in our landscape of Florida.
So you are kind of an explorer of disappearing Florida, and that's what the book is about, is exploring different aspects of it, I guess. Is that what Lost and Found means in the subtitle?
Well, it does, and actually there's a couple of meanings there. I mean, salvaging actually does apply to salvaging, as in resurrecting something that's worthwhile, and that something worthwhile is Florida, the natural places in Florida. But also at the same time, salvaging relates to a couple of stories in which I talk about treasure salvers and people who are actually working on salvaging projects in which I've been involved in Florida. So it has a sort of metaphoric meaning and a real meaning. And in the same way, so does Lost and Found, because several times I do get lost. You know, I'm out in the woods somewhere, I'm out in the swamp, and I get lost, and it's okay, though, because sooner or later I'm figuring I'm going to find my way out. And while I'm lost physically, I make the point metaphorically that you can't be found if you're never lost.
That's true, yeah.
So by being lost, you have a chance for a bit of personal salvation, if you will. You know, and the other very ironic thing about Florida, of course, is that, you know, it's seen by so many people as very known and even tame. Mm. John Sayles' movie Sunshine State, these guys are playing golf in Florida, and they refer to Florida as nature on a leash.
Huh.
So there's that perception, but we have in Florida probably more land than any other state that's preserved publicly. Almost 33% of our land and water is in public ownership, whether it's federal or state or county natural lands. Most states have only 15 or 16%. So we have a load of land, and I can go out not far from where I live, and around the Wakaga River system, there's 110 square miles publicly protected. You can flat out get lost in a place like that.
Man, I didn't realize that this state was so full of public lands. That's great. I gather then from what you're saying that you have gotten lost a few times, and I suspect you're somebody who is a little hard to get lost. You probably pay attention to your surroundings and where you came from and where you're going, and so I gather from that you probably don't use a GPS. Would that be a good guess?
Well, I specifically try not to use one, and if I'm walking or paddling with somebody, I don't encourage them to do it, although some folks find it difficult not to do that. But I'm finding a good compass. And a map can probably tell you everything you want to know as long as you pay attention to where you are.
I guess for many thousands or a few thousand years, those simple tools worked just fine for people to get somewhere and get back and know where they were. You mentioned treasure hunters. We've had Bob Marks and a few other people, John DeBry, other people who were very successful seekers of wrecked ships and finders of wrecked ships. Bob Marks insists on being called a treasure finder, not a treasure hunter, because he is more often than not finding it than just hunting for it. So have you done a lot of treasure diving, and have you been with, who are some of the people we might know who you've done some of that with?
Well, in the book, Court, I mean, I refer to Mel Fisher sort of offhandedly, because I had at one point spent some time with him years ago when I was working for Newsweek after he first, he and his crew first found Yotosha.
Right.
I spent some time down there with him, did a big piece for that magazine, and later did a piece about another salvaging expedition. And while the prize wasn't money, it was treasure of another sort. It was the ship that the great short story writer Stephen Crane and novelist Stephen Crane was on when it was headed to Cuba back around the turn of the last century, which sunk off of the coast of New Smyrna Beach, Daytona Beach area. That was a ship that kind of put him and three other guys into a small dinghy for like a couple days in these really rough seas, because it's in January. You know how it can get cold and it can get pretty raw out there in Florida.
Yeah.
And so put him into that boat, and because of that experience, he wrote his definitive short story called The Open Boat.
Yep.
So we were diving. I was diving with a few guys who were actually looking for the Commodore, the ship that had sank, that was on its way to Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
They had put Crane in a situation where he almost lost his life, and he, you know, did live to tell about the tale. But they, for the first time, they were looking to pinpoint the exact place where the Commodore had actually come to rest. And so that was treasure, if you will, of another kind, sort of a literary treasure.
Sure. You know, historical and cultural. So you found it, I gather.
Yeah. They had found it. And I went out there. We went out actually on the day, New Year's Eve day, so the day before New Year's, and there was a bad storm that had been blowing, and it just changed, the wind direction changed diametrically. So we had this, like, about a 3 to 4 hour sort of window where we could go out and dive, and it was still pretty calm before the force of the wind picked up from the other direction. So we did that, and the guy showed me what they had found, showed me the ship. We, I think it was about 90 feet deep, went down, pretty bad visibility, went down following a rope to the bottom. And then as you got closer to the bottom, the hole, you could see where the outline of the ship had been. And there was the steel boilers of it were still there.
Hmm.
And there was a lot of shells where the actual wood had been. But most of the wood was either under the sand or had gone by then.
Wow, that's neat. Well, looking through your book, and I did read that story, and there were like 47 separate essays and stories in your book, Salvaging the Real Florida. And I noticed that at least 2/3 of them, I would say, deal with water in one way or another, either like that one in the ocean, but more often inland waters or even underground waters. So is that deliberate on your part?
Yeah, it is. And water really has a lot to do with Florida, probably more than any other state I know of, Court. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons why Florida was really one of the last states to be settled. After World War II, Florida was the least densely settled state east of the Mississippi. So, you know, when Marjorie Kennett Rollins was living here back in the 40s, I mean, there were 2 million people in Florida, and most of them were living around the coast. Most of the inland of Florida was considered to be marsh and swamp and so forth, and that's before we became so clever with all of our dredges and all that,
right.
You know, and then when we developed the technology, and then a lot of the water went away. But Florida still has an awful lot of water because we're so flat. We do have a lot of rivers, and they're not confined by these northern valleys that you find back on the continent up north, where a river sits nicely inside of this nice sort of furrow.
Hmm.
You know, our rivers here tend to be flat. They will spread out over the terrain because they're not always confined by a very defined valley. You know, the valleys here are more oceanic scarps than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So they tend to roam a bit around the countryside. There are a lot of swamps still left. There are marshes everywhere. And we've got more springs than any other region in the entire world, to my knowledge.
Yeah. And of course, the Everglades is, you know, the river of grass. It's what, 6 inches to a couple feet deep, or used to be, and, you know, 50 miles wide at different points and just flowing slowly. It's basically a river, but it's a slowly moving swamp. And the springs that you're talking about come from the aquifers that perforate and penetrate the limestone karst underneath the state. So the whole state is kind of honeycombed like a sponge underneath, and much of it full of water, and it springs up in the springs, right? And that spawns rivers. So you've done a lot of filmmaking and diving in those springs. We had a guest on a year or so back, year and a half, maybe, Wes Skiles, who was maybe the premier underwater filmmaker in the world. And tragically, he died diving a few months ago. I know you knew him.
Yeah, that was terrible. Wes was a really good guy. I learned a lot from him. When I first met with him 25 or 30 years ago, he helped me understand a lot about the spring system, a lot about how our karst environment works, how water is a finite resource, and we have to be very careful about the water that goes into the ground that powers our springs. And this is probably one of the things that folks now are just beginning to understand. And Wes was saying this for a long time. He said, even if you protect the place where the springs come out of the ground, that is, you buy the land, you make it a state park, such as you might at Wakaiva State Park, for instance, if you don't protect the place where the water goes in the ground, that is, the uplands, the scrub, the sand hills, mm-hmm. where the springs are recharged by rainfall, and which can be miles and miles away from where the spring actually comes up.
Yeah.
So he said, you know, if you don't protect those areas where the spring is recharged, then sooner or later, you're going to lose that spring. So Wes was a visionary in that way, you know, and he was a very courageous guy, and he was an artist. So all these things, plus he was down home and just a lot of fun, and a lot of folks really miss him.
Yeah, just before he passed away, he had the cover story on National Geographic, and the photographs that accompanied that story and were online on National Geographic's site were just stunning. I mean, otherworldly. It just hard to believe it was Earth. They were just so colorful and exotic and beautiful. But anyway, you're right that the water wonderland under Florida is more extensive, really, than the above ground wonderland that's turned into, you know, more and more a giant theme park and housing development. And that land, that wonderland under the surface, is not undisturbed by what goes on above it. And it's not like there's a source that you can protect either. It might be a source that's, you know, 100 square miles that recharges the aquifer under there, that then finally produces a spring or two, right? So,
right. We're learning more and more where those sources are, and we can identify where the really vulnerable places are for separate springs. You know, you can identify where the recharge is, for instance, for Blue Spring, place where the manatees come in Orange City. You can identify within that recharge places that are more vulnerable to what goes on the surface than others because they're more porous. So we do have the science to be able to do that now.
Well, that's good. It's improving, and I'm glad that we're able to protect it to some extent anyway. So can I ask you to read a passage from your new book, Salvaging the Real Florida?
Sure, I'd be happy to. And again, as you explained very well earlier, Court, the book itself is a series of narratives, it's a series of stories, and some of these stories may seem a little adventurous, but I don't go in them for the adventure. I mean, I go there simply to have a look around, to see what I can find, to a Saatchi Karr once told us, the great natural Saatchi Karr, is, you know, like, we can discover things in our landscape, and we can also have a bit of fun doing it. So I think that's what drives me as much as anything. So some of these will seem a bit tame, and then you get into them a bit, and they may change character, because that's how natural places often are.
Mm-hmm. But I have to admit, we don't mind a little adventurousness here. So so go ahead. This is going to be one story from Salvaging the Real Florida.
Sure, I'll read a bit. And the title of this one is Florida Fantasyland, Bella Florista.
So Bella Florista?
Bella Florista, yeah,
okay.
That's the name of a development that's inappropriately placed, you know, right near the boundary of this wonderful natural area.
Okay, gotcha.
Anyways, here's the, puts you right in the moment. This is the lead, and this takes you into the story itself. She's a brute of a reptile as large as my kayak, and she's up on all four legs, running towards me like a giant lumbering dog. I'm wedged into the cockpit of my small craft, its bow grounded atop the mud at the edge of the bulrush hideaway. I'm holding my paddle in a white-knuckled death grip, but am otherwise paralyzed. My only reaction is to exhale in a low distress groan of the sort bad movie actors make when mutant zombies have a face full grip on their heads. As the gator reaches the edge of the low bank, she actually launches herself towards me, becoming airborne for the briefest moment. Then she belly flops into the river, splashing me with water and duckweed and mud. Within seconds, she disappears between beneath the surface, only the swirl of small eddies and the thump-thump of my heart left to remind me she was here at all. My intellect tells me I frightened her, and she was only trying to escape the deeper water. But my gut tells me I was almost toast.
Yeah, it's kind of like looking down the barrel of a gun, and luckily it wasn't loaded or intending to fire at you.
It's true, and Edward Hoagland, who's a wonderful essayist, once said that nature predates art. You know, it predates thoughtful art. So we're talking nature, gut versus intellect, and I think the intellect's going to prevail on those moments.
And I guess when you're stuck in a kayak, your fight or flight reflex doesn't really work because you can't fly and you can't do much to fight either.
Exactly. So you have your low distress groan and then you kind of hope for the best. And there you are.
Well, luckily you didn't roll over and drown in the process. So. We're talking with author and explorer and naturalist and filmmaker and diver and all things exploratory about Florida, Bill Belville. Bill, where are you from? Are you a native Floridian?
No, I grew up on the eastern shore of Maryland, which at that time was a fairly isolated rural peninsula, and it was that's the part of the state that's separated from the rest of it by the Chesapeake Bay. Mm-hmm. It was a great place to grow up, and I had great folks that who were very encouraging to me in just about everything I did, and you know, they taught me not to be afraid of having little adventures. And one of the cool things we did was, as a kid, the family, we drove to Florida to visit. My granddad had lived down there, Wauchula, and I was 8 years old when I first came to Florida for the visit. And back then, there wasn't Disney World or any of the big corporate amusement parks, and most of the attractions were built around natural features in the landscape, such as Silver Springs. And we went to Silver Springs, and we rode on the glass-bottom boats. And I looked down through the glass, and you could see this beautiful, sort of mythical, just ethereal world underneath. And I'm thinking, man, this is unbelievable. I want to come back. And I did. And not long after I was out of college, I came back. My wife and I had moved to Florida with the idea of finding a job at a newspaper to learn to write, because that was what I had always wanted to do. My background was in English literature, but I had no skill, so I figured if I was going to learn to write in a place, Ignace will be a place that I would really have fun, you know, exploring. And so began my love affair with Florida.
I've been on the Eastern Shore, and it's, you know, it's not like Florida, but you're right, it is, you know, 25 years or so, 30 years ago, there was a lot of nature there. In fact, I can remember spending a long weekend out on Tangier Island in the middle of Chesapeake Bay, which was, you know, they remark on the accent of the people there as being Elizabethan England. And it really was. I mean, it was so isolated. There was once a day for 5 days a week, I guess, there was a ferry that went back and forth from the mainland. But mainly everybody there was just an oysterman or an oyster woman. And it was a very isolated place. And it was like stepping back in time, I don't know, a good 30, 40 years, even at that time, which was probably the early 80s.
It probably was, Court. I remember Tangier and Smith Island. Mm-hmm. A lot of folks live and still do, and how they were more isolated, and the shore, to a lesser extent, was isolated because as a little boy, I mean, the only way you could get to the shore was through ferries. So if you came from Baltimore to Washington, you took a ferry. If you came from Norfolk, you took a ferry.
Well, speaking of used to be, what are some of your main influences, both past and present? I mean, who did you get immersed in that kind of influenced you?
Well, there were quite a few, Court. I mean, there were writers who influenced me for what they wrote, like John McPhee, for instance, who told these wonderful stories and his sort of the seminal book on Florida that he wrote was Oranges. And he was one of the first I read. And when I said, wow, this guy is turning nonfiction into an art, it's creative. It's more than I've ever imagined nonfiction can be. And this was years ago when he came to Florida, spent some time here, wrote about the ridge and orange growing, and you know, as McPhee does so well, traced the entire information and history of oranges, and traces it and tells it through his wonderful narrative skills. So as a narrator and a storyteller, I mean, that guy was hugely important to me. And then when I got into Florida and I began to read what others had written here over time, I'm still impressed to this day. I'm still discovering writers. And, you know, I was very influenced by William Bartram, who was here in the 1760s and 1770s. Mm. In his book, he wrote about his travels throughout the Southeast, which was called Travels, published in 1791. Even though he was in other places, Georgia and Alabama, he seemed to be most affected, most impressed, or in awe with the experiences in Florida. He came up the St. John's River. He visited some of our springs on the St. John's along the Suwannee River. And he just seemed to be enthralled by it. And it really, that sense of the thrill that he had and that sort of childlike wonder was something that impressed me, because it went along with his own very precise skills of observation, you know, and that's important for any writer to understand. And then after Bartram, of course, got into guys like Archie Carr. What a great guy, you know, just a super superb scientist, you know, and by all accounts a great teacher, but who wrote over at least 10 books that appealed to lay folks in Florida and everywhere, and helped us understand an awful lot about ecology and how ecological systems work. You know, it wasn't just about straight natural history. It was about the more intricate sort of weave of ecology and how other people in the landscape, whether they're in Florida, whether they're in Latin America or the Antilles, how those people are also part of the larger ecological equation. They're not separate from it. So I was very, I was taken with the whole thing and the idea of paying attention not just to the ecological systems, but how other people interacted with them and how their lives were affected by them, inspired by them, and so on.
And you became a naturalist. You're listening to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with Bill Belville, who's an author and a naturalist and a filmmaker based in and centered on old Florida. Florida and its many, many guises and its many reflections that are disappearing in many ways, but are still there and still visible in many ways, too. Bill, I mentioned that you're a filmmaker. You do documentary films. How many of them have you done so far?
Well, we started about 10 years ago. We started a nonprofit organization called Equinox Documentaries, and we got our 501c3, so we're able to do nonprofit work with the mission of conservation and nature and helping folks understand sense of place. And in that time, we've done 7 or 8 films. Most recently, we did an hour-long PBS film, which I think embodied the sort of work that we do. The film is called In Marjorie's Wake, In Search of Rollins, A River in Time. It was about the wonderful Pulitzer-winning writer, Marjorie Kinnan Rollins, who, of course, as we know, lived in Cross Creek and wrote the Yearling and Golden Apples and South Moon Under and, of course, Cross Creek and many other books. And she was an exquisite writer. And I mentioned that Archie Carr was he had a great grasp of details, as did Rollins. So she understood the places where she went. She talked to people. She learned about where she lived. You know, she understood how the culture, the vernacular culture of the place, was shaped by the place itself, shaped by the geography. So the film had to do with a journey she once took on the St. John's River. She left Cross Creek, and she came down south of Orlando to southern part of Puzzle Lake. Very difficult place. It's a labyrinthal, marshy maze. And she and her neighbor, Desi Prescott Smith, spent 10 days coming back. They had somebody haul them there by trailer. They left them there, and they spent the next 10 days coming downstream on the river, going through Puzzle Lake, going through Lake Harney, Lake Monroe, Lake George, all the way down the river, and finally until they reached Akawaha. They went up the Akawaha and then back to Cross Creek. She wrote about that in one of the chapters in her book, Cross Creek, and that chapter was called Hyacinth Drift. So what we did was we found two modern women, who were willing to like retrace the journey itself. And we didn't reenact it. Our intent was not to reenact it historically at all, but to identify the women, who they were. One was Leslie Poole, who's a writer and a professor at Rollins College here in Winter Park. The other is Jennifer Chase, who's a playwright and musician and also an educator up in Jacksonville. And so we put them together and said, well, have at it, ladies. You know, here you go. You got 10 days, you got a boat, and we'll follow you along. And, you know, it's pretty much up to you. You can do whatever you want. And they were great. They're both very bright women, and they were funny. And it was fun to be with them. And it was fun to do the piece that we ended up doing. So that just finished a two-year run on national PBS. And it's available now by DVD, and we're very impressed and touched, actually, that high school and college classes are using the film when they study Rollins.
Well, that's a great project, and I'm glad it had such success. People can go to equinoxdocumentaries.org to see more about your films, Equinox, E-Q-U-I-N-O-X, documentaries.org. Well, you know, I would say a lot of hikers and kayakers and so on like looking at wild nature when they go into parks and wilder places in Florida. But, you know, I think maybe a lot of them are more interested in the achievement itself and in checking off a list. What do you think is, to wrap up here a little bit, what's the best attitude for people to take when they're exploring a wild place, Bill?
That's a good question, Corey. I try to go out, whether I'm by myself or whether I'm with a partner, I try to stay open to what the possibilities are and try not to have a lot of preconceived ideas of what the experience is going to be. And look, you know, you may go there with an idea of searching for something. For instance, maybe you're looking for a small freshwater spring that's newly been charted, and you can kind of find it if you hunt around, you look at the isobars on the map and find your way there. So that's a cool thing, but along the way, you may find a lot of other discoveries too, animals, plants, things you never counted on. So for me, if you keep an open heart and open mind, I mean, you can still have a great adventure in Florida. As long as you get out, and you get out, you allow yourself that luxury of getting out and allowing yourself to roam and try not to put an overlay of civilization on top of everything. So everything has to be a certain way. Just let it happen, man. Just let it go.
Good advice. So what's your most optimistic hope for the future of natural Florida 10, 15, 20 years, the next boom? Is there going to be anything left, wild and natural?
Well, that's a good question. My best hope is that we come to our senses and we understand that to really sustain our natural places, it's going to take more than political sound bites. It's going to take really hard work. And if people tell you something's going to be easy because here's a simple soundbite, then run the other direction because they usually don't know what in the world they're talking about. If we can manage our natural lands by ecological laws rather than all the sort of craziness of politics, then we have a chance. But if we succumb to that and let this sort of reactionary stuff go on, regardless of where it comes from, what political arena, if we allow that to happen and we ignore the ecological needs of our landscape, then we're going to be left with nothing.
Well, we hope we're left with at least something of what we have now. Bill Belville, thank you so much for being on with us. As usual, we could have made this an hour show, but we have just a mere half hour here in American Variety. So thanks again.
You're very welcome. It's my pleasure, Court.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.